Joshua, chapters 3 through 5, the second talk in a series on the narrative portions of Joshua, was presented by David Crabtree on October 16, 2005 at Reformation Fellowship. The copyright for this recording is held by Gutenberg College, Inc., 2005. Gutenberg College is a nonprofit organization, and contributions may be made at www.gutenberg.edu. This material may be copied and distributed in whole for non-commercial and educational purposes, subject to the inclusion of this introduction. All other rights reserved.
We'll be looking at the book of Joshua today, chapter 3. I'm planning to go through almost three chapters, so we'll be sprinting. The Israelites are on the east bank of the Jordan. They're up on the high plateau on the east side of the Jordan, and they had sent spies over to spy out Jericho. Those spies have gone, and they have returned, and now it's time to move. But they don't seem to be in any particular hurry, as the narrative shows, and they'll be kind of taking their time, making their way towards Jericho, and the people in Jericho must be scared to death and getting scareder as the time goes by. These three chapters are not in strict chronological order. There's some sloppiness in here chronologically, but I think we just have to grant that to the author rather than seeing that as errors or indications of various sources being sloppily put together. It's just an author not being as meticulously concerned about keeping everything in chronological order because he has other purposes to achieve. In these chapters, what we're going to see is a transition taking place, a transition in the way that God is interacting with his people. It's different from the way that he interacted with them in the Exodus. And you can be looking for indications of that, and I'll talk about that more at the end. Chapter 3, verses 1 through 6. Then Joshua rose early in the morning, and he and all the sons of Israel set out from Shittim and came to the Jordan. And they lodged there before they crossed. And it came about at the end of 3 days that the officers went through the midst of the camp, and they commanded the people, saying, "When you see the Ark of the Covenant of the Lord your God, with the Levitical priests carrying it, then you shall set out from your place and go after it. However, there shall be between you and it a distance of about 2,000 cubits by measure. Do not come near it, that you may know the way by which you shall go, for you have not passed this way before." Then Joshua said to the people, "Consecrate yourselves, for tomorrow the Lord will do wonders among you." And Joshua spoke to the priests, saying, "Take up the Ark of the Covenant and cross over ahead of the people." So they took up the Ark of the Covenant and went ahead of the people. Now, it says that Joshua rose up early. That's a phrase that occurs a number of times in the Pentateuch, and usually it's indicative of something momentous to come. He rose up early. That means something significant. He's going to do something significant that day. And indeed, there is the beginning of something that's very significant that happens. They broke camp on the higher plateau on the other side of the Jordan. And I don't know at that location what the elevation is, but in general, that higher plateau is about 3,000 to 4,000 feet high. And they're going to go down to an elevation that's below, certainly the Dead Sea is below sea level. I don't know if the Jordan there is below sea level, but it's quite low. So it's at least a 4,000-foot drop. That's quite a ways down. And as I understand the geography, it drops off steeply for a few thousand feet. And then as you get closer to the Jordan, there's a bench. And the bench is quite wide in that particular location. It's narrower as you go north, but it widens out as you get closer to the Dead Sea. And they're almost at the northern end of the Dead Sea. So the bench is quite wide there. So they're coming down this very steep embankment, several thousand foot drop down onto this bench. And this bench is quite wide. And then there's another drop down to the bed of the river. So I think that what's happening is they're making that initial descent down to the bench, and they're probably camping on that bench. And they'll camp there for 3 days. They're told now that they are supposed to follow the ark. There is no more mention of the cloud and the pillar of fire that had guided them during the Exodus through the wilderness. So they are not mentioned again. So I would assume that those cease to be these phenomena that are leading the Israelites on their way. And that's being replaced by the Ark of the Covenant. The Ark of the Covenant will now lead them and direct them. And that's interesting because we're moving from natural phenomenon to now a box. They were being led by something that was a true phenomenon, that was clearly out of the ordinary. And now it's a box made by human hands that they will be following. Joshua says, consecrate yourselves. He wants them to go through, there's a set of procedures that they go through to consecrate themselves, to purify themselves ceremonially, because something significant is going to happen, and they are to prepare themselves for that. God is going to show himself in their midst through a wonder. Okay, and so they're camped on this bench. They can probably see the Jordan right below them. We find out later in the text that the Jordan is at flood stage. Every spring, the Jordan floods. And in historical times, there have been floods that have risen to the level of actually going up onto the bench. But that's very rare. Usually the flood stage is well below the bench. In any case, they can see the Jordan from where they're camped in all likelihood. And it looks like a formidable crossing. The river is quite wide there. When it floods, it flows quite swiftly. And the depth of the river when it is not at flood stage there is about 12 feet. So it must be well above 12 feet depth at that particular spot. And even at non-flood stage, it's considered to be quite an accomplishment to swim across the Jordan at that location. So it must look a bit ominous. And they have 3 days to think about it. Next section. Now the Lord said to Joshua, this day I will begin to exalt you in the sight of all Israel, that you may know that just as I have been with Moses, I will be with you. You shall, moreover, command the priests who are carrying the Ark of the Covenant, saying, when you come to the edge of the waters of the Jordan, you shall stand still in the Jordan. Then Joshua said to the sons of Israel, come here and hear the words of the Lord your God. And Joshua said, by this you shall know that the living God is among you, and that he will assuredly dispossess from before you the Canaanite, the Hittite, the Hivite, the Perizzite, the Girgashite, the Amorite, and the Jebusite. Behold, the Ark of the Covenant of the Lord of all the earth is crossing over ahead of you into the Jordan. Now then, take for yourselves 12 men from the tribes of Israel, one man for each tribe. And it shall come about, when the soles of the feet of the priests who carry the Ark of the Lord of all the earth, shall rest in the waters of the Jordan, the waters of the Jordan shall be cut off, and the waters which are flowing down from above shall stand in one heap. So God comes to Joshua, and he says that he is going to act in a way that will demonstrate that God is with Joshua, that Joshua's authority is God-given, and that he ought to be followed by the people of Israel. And the way that he's going to accomplish that is the priests, when they carry this ark, as soon as they step into the waters of the waters of the Jordan are going to pile up, it says, behind them. And therefore, the Israelites will walk across on dry ground rather than having to swim. And it says that by this you shall know that the living God is among you, so that God is among you, and that he will assuredly dispossess from before you all these peoples. So God is among you, and you will be victorious as you go into this land you will replace these peoples. And furthermore, it refers to, in verse 13, talking about when the ark goes into the water, refers to the Lord as the Lord of all the earth. So this is also going to be a demonstration that God is not just a local God. This is not just one of many gods. This is the God of gods. This is the God of all the earth. Okay, next section. Now it came about when the people set out from their tents to cross the Jordan with the priests carrying the Ark of the Covenant before the people. And when those who carried the Ark came to the Jordan, and the feet of the priests carrying the Ark were dipped in the edge of the water, for the Jordan overflows all its banks all the days of harvest, that the waters which were flowing down from above stood and rose up in one heap, a great distance away at Adam, the city that is beside Zarethan. And those which were flowing down toward the Sea of the Arabah, the Salt Sea, were completely cut off. So the people crossed opposite Jericho, and the priests who carried the Ark of the Covenant of the Lord stood firm on dry ground in the middle of the Jordan, while all Israel crossed on dry ground, until all the nation had finished crossing the Jordan. So it happens just as God had said that it would. The priests who were carrying the Ark, they step into the waters of the Jordan, and the Jordan, the water stops. And how does it stop? Well, the waters pile up, and it's not clear exactly how they pile up, but it says that it happens at Adam, which is across from Zarethan, all of which would be very helpful if we knew where Adam and Zarethan were located. There are archaeologists have guessed that it's a place about 20 miles north of where they are crossing. There is an area there where the River Jordan goes through a narrow valley. The valley is much narrower there, closer in, with the steep banks right next to the river. And there are two times in history, one in 1267 and the other one in 1927, when there were huge landslides from one side of the bank that swept down, blocked off the Jordan for a number of hours until the water backed up behind these new earth dams and eventually washed it out. So in both cases, the Jordan downstream from those dams was dried up for a number of hours, and then the waters broke through once again and came down. So it could be that that's exactly the phenomenon that happened here. And if that's what happened, then God achieved this miracle not by a means that is contrary to the laws of physics, but rather what's miraculous about it is the timing. That this very rare event occurred just when everything was set up for it, and just when God said it would happen. Next section. Now it came about, when all the nation had finished crossing the Jordan, that the Lord spoke to Joshua, saying, "Take for yourselves 12 men from the people, one man from each tribe, and command them, saying, 'Take up for yourselves 12 stones from here out of the middle of the Jordan, from the place where the priest's feet are standing firm, and carry them over with you, and lay them down in the lodging place where you will lodge tonight.' So Joshua called the 12 men whom he had appointed from the sons of Israel, one man from each tribe. And Joshua said to them, 'Cross again to the ark of the Lord your God into the middle of the Jordan, and each of you take up a stone on his shoulder, according to the number of the tribes of the sons of Israel. Let this be a sign among you, so that when your children ask later, saying, "What do these stones mean to you?" then you shall say to them, "Because the waters of the Jordan were cut off before the Ark of the Covenant of the Lord, when it crossed the Jordan, the waters of the Jordan were cut off. So these stones shall become a memorial to the sons of Israel forever." It had mentioned that they were supposed to select out one man from each tribe earlier, and now we see what why that was. The priests carrying the ark are standing in the middle of the Jordan. The Jordan is dry. The people have crossed. And now these 12 representatives, one from each tribe, are supposed to go back into the riverbed, pick up a stone, and carry it out of the riverbed, and a monument will be built out of these 12 stones. Why? So that when their sons ask, what are these? What's this pile of stones for? What does it indicate? The answer is going to be, because God kept back the waters of the Jordan so that we could cross the river on dry ground. Next section. And thus the sons of Israel did, as Joshua commanded, and took up 12 stones from the middle of the Jordan, just as the Lord spoke to Joshua, according to the number of the tribes of the sons of Israel. And they carried them over with them to the lodging place and put them down there. Then Joshua set up 12 stones from the middle of the Jordan at the place where the feet of the priests who carried the Ark of the Covenant were standing. And they are there to this day. For the priests who carried the Ark were standing in the middle of the Jordan until everything was completed that the Lord had commanded Joshua to speak to the people, according to all that Moses had commanded Joshua. And the people hurried and crossed. And it came about when all the people had finished crossing that the Ark of the Lord and the priests crossed before the people. And the sons of Reuben and the sons of Gad and the half-tribe of Manasseh crossed over in battle array before the sons of Israel, just as Moses had spoken to them. About 40,000 equipped for war crossed for battle before the Lord to the desert plains of Jericho. On that day the Lord exalted Joshua in the sight of all Israel, so that they revered him just as they had revered Moses in all the days of his life. So they did as they were told. They took the 12 stones out, and they're going to pile those up where they spend the night. But Joshua does something else, and that is he takes 12 stones and piles them up in the middle of the riverbed. So they'll be right in the middle of the river once the river starts to flow again. And it says, and they are there to this day. So that's referring to the time of the writing of this book, which seems to indicate that there must have been some time that passed between the events described in this book and when it was written. In any case, there's this second monument in the middle of the river, presumably only visible when the water is low. If the water is high, I would assume it couldn't be seen, but it depends how clear the water is, I suppose. And as had been promised, the tribes that wanted to stay on the east side of the Jordan and reached an agreement with Moses that they would go into the promised land and help the Israelites take the land, they are leading the way. They're sending in 40,000 soldiers who will lead the way. And they did just as they had promised. Next section. Now the Lord said to Joshua, command the priests who carry the Ark of the Testimony that they come up from the Jordan. So Joshua commanded the priests, saying, come up from the Jordan. And it came about when the priests who carried the Ark of the Covenant of the Lord had come up from the middle of the Jordan, and the soles of the priests' feet were lifted up to the dry ground, that the waters of the Jordan returned to their banks and went over all its banks as before. Now the people came up from the Jordan on the 10th of the first month and camped at Gilgal on the eastern edge of Jericho. And those 12 stones which they had taken from the Jordan, Joshua set up at Gilgal. And he said to the sons of Israel, when your children ask their fathers in time to come, saying, what are these stones? Then you shall inform your children, saying, Israel crossed this Jordan on dry ground. For the Lord your God dried up the waters of the Jordan before you until you had crossed, just as the Lord your God had done to the Red Sea, which he dried up before us until we had crossed, that all the peoples of the earth may know that the hand of the Lord is mighty, so that you may fear the Lord your God forever. So the priests leave the riverbed, the water starts to flow again and overflows its banks, and the people take those stones with them to Gilgal, which is apparently where they spend the night, that first night, They take the stones there and they set up a monument there in Gilgal. And they are supposed to, whenever their children look at those stones, what they're supposed to say is, Israel crossed this Jordan on dry ground. For the Lord your God dried up the waters of the Jordan before you until you had crossed, just as the Lord your God had done to the Red Sea, which he dried up before us until we had crossed, that all the peoples of the earth may know that the hand of the Lord is mighty, so that you may fear the Lord your God forever. So that becomes the significance of those, that pile of stones. Okay, last section, it's the first 12 verses of chapter 5. Now it came about when all the kings of the Amorites who were beyond the Jordan to the west, and all the kings of the Canaanites who were by the sea, heard how the Lord had dried up the waters of the Jordan before the sons of Israel until they had crossed, that their hearts melted, and there was no spirit in them any longer because of the sons of Israel. At that time the Lord said to Joshua, make for yourself flint knives and circumcise again the sons of Israel the second time. So Joshua made himself flint knives and circumcised the sons of Israel at Gibeath Arloth. And this is the reason why Joshua circumcised them. All the people who came out of Egypt, who were males, all the men of war, died in the wilderness along the way after they came out of Egypt. For all the people who came out were circumcised. But all the people who were born in the wilderness along the way as they came out of Egypt had not been circumcised. For the sons of Israel walked 40 years in the wilderness until all the nation, that is, the men of war who came out of Egypt, perished because they did not listen to the voice of the Lord, to whom the Lord had sworn that he would not let them see the land which the Lord had sworn to their fathers to give us, a land flowing with milk and honey. And their children, whom he raised up in their place, Joshua circumcised, for they were uncircumcised because they had not circumcised them along the way. Now it came about when they had finished circumcising all the nation that they remained in their places in the camp until they were healed. Then the Lord said to Joshua, today I have rolled away the reproach of Egypt from you. So the name of that place is called Gilgal to this day. While the sons of Israel camped at Gilgal, they observed the Passover on the evening of the 14th day of the month on the desert plains of Jericho. And on the day after the Passover, on that very day, they ate some of the produce of the land, unleavened cakes and parched grain. And the manna ceased on the day after they had eaten some of the produce of the land, so that the sons of Israel no longer had manna, but they ate some of the yield of the land of Canaan during that year. The people in Jericho are scared to death now. If they weren't scared before, they're scared now. Because news of this, of what had happened, must have made its way around Canaan very quickly. That is, that the waters of the Jordan had stopped. And during that time, the Israelites had gone through on dry ground. So the people of Jericho are scared to death, and the Israelites are in no hurry. They're waiting here on the other side of the Jordan. They aren't moving towards Jericho immediately. They're just sitting there. And with each day, the people of Jericho must be getting more and more frightened. I mean, they've been on high alert, and now they're on extra high alert, and it looks very ominous. While they're here on the other side, God commands that Joshua have circumcised all of the males that are not circumcised. And the explanation given for this is there was a circumcision that was carried on when all of the males were circumcised. But those men, at least, those who were adults at the time that that occurred, they're all dead. They died in the 40 years that transpired. Others have been born. And apparently, they were not circumcised. Now, why they were not circumcised, I don't know. At the law given on Sinai, it was commanded, I think, on the eighth day that every male was supposed to be circumcised. And apparently they didn't do that. Now, did they not do that because they forgot? Did they not do that because it was inconvenient? I don't know. There are some commentators who say that it's because during the 40 years they were experiencing the punishment of God, and as a result of that, they were commanded not to circumcise their sons as a recognition of the fact that they were undergoing a punishment. I don't know if that is an adequate explanation or not. There's no real indication that that was the case. But there's no indication of why they didn't circumcise. But in any case, they didn't. And so now they've been asked to circumcise. Joshua's been told to circumcise all the males. In doing so, as we see elsewhere in the Old Testament, when the males of a community are circumcised, there are a period of days when they are not up to doing much. And so there is a period of time here when they are really vulnerable. And that's not a problem. There's no indication that they're worried about that. And the reason it's not a problem is the Canaanites are so frightened, they aren't coming after the Israelites. That's not going to happen. They aren't going to leave their walls. They're going to stay behind their walls. And it says that today I have rolled away the reproach of Egypt from you. I'm not sure what the reproach of Egypt is. Is it the fact that they were enslaved for several hundred years? Is that the reproach of Egypt? Or there's another possibility, and that is the reproach of Egypt would be the taunts of the Egyptians that if the Israelites are led out into the desert by their God, they will die in that desert. They will be left to die in that desert by their God. There are two times that Moses refers to that. That there are two times when God is wanting to punish the Israelites for wrongdoing. And Moses appeals to God and says, if you kill the Israelites, then the Egyptians will say that you led your people out in the desert just to die. Let's look at one of those passages. I hope I wrote that down. Exodus 32:12. This is after Moses had received the tablets from God up on Mount Sinai, had come down, and they had built a golden calf in the meantime. And so God is suggesting, well, I'll just wipe them all out and start over with you. And Moses says, no, that would not be good. And he starts, let's start verse 11. Then Moses entreated the Lord with his God and said, O Lord, why doth thine anger burn against thy people, whom thou hast brought out from the land of Egypt with great power and with a mighty hand? Why should the Egyptians speak, saying, with evil intent he brought them out to kill them in the mountains and to destroy them from the face of the earth? Turn from thy burning anger and change thy mind about doing harm to thy people, etc. My suspicion is that's the reproach of Egypt. The potential that people elsewhere, and particularly in Egypt, would say, your God just took you out into the desert to let you die there. And the fact that he has just led them across the Jordan into the promised land as he had promised means that that reproach, that taunt, can no longer come to pass. So I suspect that's the reproach that's being talked about. Then they observe Passover. This is the first Passover that's being observed in the promised land. And notice that, let's see, I think it's the day after Passover then that the manna ceases to be supplied by God. So there are a number of changes that are taking place here. The pillar of fire and the cloud are no longer there. The manna is no longer being provided. There are a number of things that are changing in this section, in the way that God is relating to his people Israel. Previously, Moses had been the one who had been leading the Israelites, and Moses had a unique relationship with God. God spoke to Moses as man to man. Moses was very active in the miracles that were performed. When the Red Sea was split, he reached out his staff. When water came out of the rock, he reached out his staff. In the plagues, he reached out his staff. So Moses is a real connection between Moses and his authority and the wonders that are being produced. In this case, Joshua doesn't do anything. It's the ark that's carried into the water. Once the priests step into the water, then the water begins to pile up. So there is not as direct a connection between Joshua and the wonders that are being produced as there was between Moses and the wonders that were produced. There is a cessation of those natural phenomena that were indicators of God's presence. The manna, the pillar of fire, and the cloud. Those are gone now. And now they're being led by a wooden box that was made by human hands. The generation that left Egypt, they were allowed to see a whole series of wondrous acts on the part of God. There were the plagues that occurred in Egypt before they even left. And then they watch the parting of the Red Sea. And they go through, and after they do that, the sea sweeps in and destroys Pharaoh's army. And then as they're going through the wilderness, God provides water miraculously, and meat in the form of quail miraculously. Water comes out of a rock. Water that's bitter is turned sweet. There are a number of very dramatic signs of God's presence that they all witness as they're making their way across the desert. This generation, the one that's going into the land, they see the Jordan dried up and they go through on dry land. But they don't get the same number and the same amount of drama that the other generation had. And what's interesting is they're supposed to pile up these rocks. And what does the next generation get? They get a look at this pile of rocks. And they say, what's this all about? And their fathers say, well, I was with the tribe of Israel when we crossed through on dry ground. So they see the rocks and they hear the testimony, the first-hand testimony of the fathers. But think about generations later. Now the rocks have fallen down. And now what do they have? They have the stories. They have the stories that my great-great-great-great-grandfather was with the Israelites when they crossed the Jordan on dry ground. So it's very interesting here. God is pulling back. During the time of the Exodus, that was one of those rare times in history when God chooses to reach into history, into human history, in a very overt fashion and make his presence visible, make it obvious. But that's the exception. That's not the way God usually operates. We have a glimpse of that in places like the Exodus, and I would say even in the life of Christ. And there are time more isolated instances in which God does remarkable things through individuals for a local area. But the Exodus was for worldwide consumption. That was for the whole world to see. That's rare. That doesn't usually happen. For the most part, God steps back. He's always at work, but not so overtly. He's at work behind the scenes, working in the lives of all of us, doing remarkable things, but not with that big stamp of overtness that he did in the Exodus. And so here we're seeing the transition. He has been very overt in human history, and he's kind of backing out. Slowly backing out. In the discussions at Gutenberg this last week, we read a work by Hume in which he challenges the accounts of the miracles in the Bible. And so I've been thinking about this issue of the significance of history to Christianity. Christianity is a historic religion. History is important to Christianity. If the claims with respect to history in the Bible are not true, then we ought not believe it. It is God reaching into history that is the indication. It's God revealing himself and revealing himself in history that is our anchor point that this is true. We are, given our fallenness, we are not capable of finding God apart from him working from his end to reveal himself. And through the acts of history, that is one of the ways that he has revealed himself and shown what he is up to, what his plan for salvation is all about, how it's going to go down. Paul argues in 2 Corinthians that if Christ did not really raise from the dead, that our faith is in vain. It's just wishful thinking, but it has no grounding in fact, in historical reality. And we as Christians should believe what is true because it's true. And we believe the gospel because it's true, not because it's the gospel. So historical reality should be important to us. And one of the ways that God has demonstrated that what he is saying is true and ought to be believed is he raised his son from the dead. The resurrection is one of the cornerstones, I think, of God's revelation. The Exodus, I think, is the Old Testament equivalent of that same thing, of God working in history, revealing himself in a way that is overt and demonstrative that he is the one that he claims to be. That's interesting to me because if you read the accounts of modern archaeologists, I would say that the majority of modern archaeologists don't think that the Exodus happened. They certainly don't think the conquest of the Promised Land happened, at least not anything like the way it's described in the Bible, if it did happen. Let alone the crossing of the Jordan. I find this interesting because, well, let's think about these monuments that were set up by the Israelites. One monument is stones taken from the bottom of the Jordan and they're put up on ground. The other one is stones that have been piled up in the bottom of the Jordan. Do either of those prove that God held back the waters so that the Israelites could pass on dry ground? They don't prove it. At least I wouldn't consider that a proof. The one where they pile the stones where otherwise you couldn't go, that seems to me a little more helpful. But it can only be seen when the water is really low. For the most part, that's not visible. The one that's on dry ground, does it prove anything? What does a pile of rocks prove? I mean, it's not really intended for proof. It's intended as a reminder. It's not for the skeptic, but it's for one who is willing to consider it sympathetically. As I think about why do I believe the historicity of what I find in the Bible? It's not because of the overwhelming evidence that we find in the Bible itself or from archaeology. but rather it's because I have come to believe that the Bible is a truth-worthy source. And I've come to believe that it's a truth-worthy source because the Bible, in what it says, is so helpful. It is so clarifying. It is so perceptive in the way that it describes reality and the life that I experience on a daily basis, that it has all the fingerprints of the one who created life in the first place. And God seems to be at work in my experiences. God is at work in my soul. That God has been bringing me along through experiences, through things that I have learned, through things I've been taught, through things that I have read in the Bible. He's been bringing me along to help me to piece together what he's up to, who he is and what he's up to. And I suspect that he has brought every individual along differently. None of us have taken the same route. But God, the Spirit of God, is at work in our hearts, bringing us along in his own mysterious way, in his own mysterious time. I have seen miracles. They aren't like the Jordan River piling up at Zarathon. But instances in which God had brought me to a point where something was subjectively very important to me, and God came through and provided just what I needed at just the right time. And so subjectively, God had set me up for this thing that came along to be really, really significant, whereas an outsider looking at it may not see the significance of it. Help at just the right time. A job at just the right time, money at just the right time. There are any number of instances where God has come through subjectively. And I've seen God at work in the lives of others. And that's been very helpful to me because it's hard to see what God is doing in your own life sometimes. You second guess, you start wondering, well, has anything really changed? Has any progress really been made? Has God really been at work in my life, or am I just making it up? Is it just wishful thinking? It's helpful then to see other people. You can look at that a little bit more objectively, with a little bit more distance, and to see God working in other people's lives and bringing about real substantial change. And hearing their stories about how the Spirit has worked in them to bring them to the place where they see the truth, that's all very, very confirming. And there's something about all of that working together that resonates with something very deep within me. There's a rightness to the way that the Bible explains the world. There's a rightness about the way that the Bible tells us we ought to live our lives. There's a rightness about the way he's working in other people's lives that's very confirming. So it's on that basis, then, that I have come to have so much faith in the Bible, such that I look at the historical accounts, and I'm willing to give them the benefit of the doubt, much like I would some person that has demonstrated himself time and time and time again to be trustworthy, who tells me a story about something that he did, and you hear contrary evidence, and it can be very compelling contrary evidence. But if this person has proven himself to be trustworthy, then no matter how compelling that evidence, I'm going to give the benefit of the doubt to the trustworthy person until that evidence reaches such a point that it is irrefutable. And I would say that as I think about the Bible and in the historical events, the Bible has shown itself to be that kind of authority, that it has shown itself time and time and time again to be trustworthy, such that when I compare what the archaeologists say with the biblical account, I'm willing to suspend judgment on what the archaeologists say, what they even insist sometimes, and give the benefit of the doubt to the to the Old Testament account of it. And I'm confident that if all of the information were in, that the historical accounts would be vindicated. But that they happened is very important. So if it could be done, if the body of Christ, the corpse, the bones of Christ could be produced, and it was irrefutable, those are the bones of Christ, then the gospel ought not be believed. Okay. Questions? Comments?
Hello? I see a parallel with the New Testament and Moses and so on, because the Israelites saw many miracles, and then when Jesus came, he showed, like the scribes, Pharisees, many of these miracles, and they didn't believe. And I think, I don't know if you agree with me, is that what we have in here is kind of a faith principle. Like the Israelites that came over into the Jordan, they had to have faith to believe what happened. And that's like what happened with Christianity. We have to have faith that that's what happened.
Well, I don't think that the Israelites needed faith to believe what happened, because they saw it. Where the faith comes in is in the significance of what happened. Mm-hmm. And there, I think that does require faith. That requires the miracle of God opening us to receiving the significance of that.
Okay, you don't agree with me on that?
Well, I don't agree. I don't think that it took faith for an Israelite to believe, that was there when it happened, to believe that God held back the waters of the Jordan. Or at least that the waters of the Jordan were held back. Well, it doesn't take faith to believe
well,
that.
Well, that's what I mean. Mm-hmm. I don't, like, when I say faith, I don't mean like the Christian faith. I mean, you have to have a belief, and that's what happened. And from that belief, you believe that God is going to help you. And that's what I see with Christianity, is that we don't see all the miracles of Jesus, but we have to believe that those are things that can happen with us, and Jesus help us, and so on. Mm-hmm. That's what I mean, the parallels.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
Thank you.
Mm-hmm. There was a hand over here someplace.
Give Roger's work out here. Do you think if there's people in Jericho seeing this going on, I mean, besides being scared, do you think they've also fled? I mean, I know there's probably no place to go, but realizing they're certainly outnumbered and with the miracles.
Well, I don't know. I can't say whether any fled, but I... Most of them stay. There are still people there when the Israelites show up, so I think most of them stay. My suspicion is they're thinking there's no better place to be. Jericho was highly fortified, so there's probably no better place to go. But they are very scared. And I think we've got this long... They've seen things. They've seen wondrous things happen, and they've had lots of time to think about it. So they're scared. And what's interesting is there's no indication of others besides Rahab seeing the significance of what's happening and responding to it accordingly. You would think there would be more, but we have no evidence of that.
The Israelites came into a land already occupied by different peoples, mm-hmm. who apparently were at war with each other anyway, because they all had castles and, you know, walled cities and whatnot. Isn't ultimately the message of the conflict between them and the Israelites is that they could have assimilated the Israelites into the land, but they could not assimilate the Israelites' God? That ultimately, as long as the Israelites claimed they were God's people, that wasn't going to be allowed. I mean, I've thought about this a lot, and I seem to feel that the real issue is not that they were rejecting the Israelites, but they were rejecting the God that, whom the Israelites declared to be God.
Mm-hmm.
And that, does that justify a war? Or were the wars just having been told by God that I will send the hornet ahead of you? And did something go wrong that there shouldn't have been a war?
That there should not have been a war?
Yeah, that the thing should have taken place because God made the land unlivable for the people already there. And that whole martial conflict issue, I think it was something you said you would discuss later, earlier. So now it's later than earlier.
But there is a later. I think that the war is justifiable in that they have indeed rejected the God of the Israelites. And I think that's the way that God justifies the war. But I think that they rejected the God of Israel. At another level, they rejected the God of Israel, much for the same reason that Pharaoh's heart was hard. And he was resistant to the appeals of Moses before the Exodus. That the Canaanites are playing a role that needs to be played in the history that God, the story that God wants to tell. But it's justified, I think, on the grounds that they would not accept the God of the Israelites. Yes.
Would God have to have hardened the hearts of 100% less one, Rahab, and presumably or however many her household, would he have had to harden all their hearts to be justified in running over them? Or was it sufficient? Let's say, for instance, that the Rahab, her heart was obviously good, in a good place. If the spies had never come to her house, had found some other way to hide and get out of the city and whatever, that wouldn't have changed the fact that her heart was in that state, and that God, it would have made sense for God to spare her. It seems to me that there are times when God judges a city or a culture, and we don't necessarily have to say that 100% of the people there are going to hell. Some of them are just, they receive the consequences of happening to be in the city where they are. It's not a judgment per se, but it's just what happens when you get too close to evil. Sometimes you're at ground zero. It doesn't really matter if you're actually not the target. Although God certainly is capable of saving everyone whose heart was right. So how do we think about that? Or is it just something we have to say, well, God could do it one way or the other. He could wipe out a culture, including 10 people whose heart were right, because ultimately he's going to do right by them, to make a statement about the culture.
Mm-hmm. No, I think it's very possible that there would be some who were genuinely responsive to God, Canaanites, who died in the conflict. I think that's very possible. He wants to paint a certain picture here, and in order to paint this picture, I think it's important that, generally speaking, the Canaanites be rebellious against the God of the Israelites. I think that's important. But that it be 100%, I don't think that's important. And people's eternal destiny is not the same as their end here in this life. So,
two things. That isn't it in Genesis where God tells Moses that the reason he delayed taking the people into the land is he was waiting for the iniquity of the Amorites to be complete.
Mm-hmm.
So him bringing Israel into Canaan was in part a judgment against the ungodliness of the Canaanite people. So
right.
It wasn't necessarily that they weren't diplomatic enough or didn't negotiate right. In a way, God had turned Israel into the aggressor, I think, if I'm reading it right.
Right, I think so.
The other point is it's just amazing to me the kinds of things that you're, I mean, the damming the Jordan River so they can go across on dry land, those things in our lives where that happens, how absolutely irrelevant most of those things come to me, not too far downstream. And it really kind of takes an effort on my part. I can see the significance of the memorial stones is they don't have to mean anything to you, but they are, like you were saying, they are a testimony to the fact that it is objective reality. Mm-hmm. It's objective reality that God did act in the way that he acted. And I can blow that off if I want to and ignore it and not think that that has any relevance to me. But if I'm smart, which I normally am not, but if I'm smart, I will consider the fact that if this is objective reality, this has implications.
Yeah.
And it's just so astonishing how unwilling we are to actually take seriously the implications of objective reality.
Yeah.
Spring or early summer, I had something happen to me in which it was just astounding to me what God had done. And at the time, I was thinking, I wish I were an Israelite. And I remember... Margaret mentioned this one time. I wish I were an Israelite so I could take a lamb to the temple and offer an offering of thanksgiving as something concrete that I could do as recognition for what God had done. But what happens is within 2 or 3 days, my recollection of how significant that was starts to decay. I mean, the half-life is, what, 10 hours? I mean, it's just incredible. And one of the things that happens is I start thinking of how likely it would have been that what happened would have happened whether there was a God or not. I can just imagine the Israelites getting on the other side of the Jordan, and then they find out that there had been a landslide upstream, and they go, oh, well, that's why it happened. It wasn't God. It was a landslide. And those happen every 1,000 years. But it is just amazing to me, and it is frustrating to me, that I can't freeze that understanding when it's happening and preserve it and prevent that decay that happens so quickly. And I don't know how to do that other than to pray to God that he will... sear that into my memory so that that I won't forget it. One more, and then we gotta quit.
Has it been discussed somewhere in the past? Have you guys discussed this whole circumcision bit? I'm having some problems with it.
I don't believe so. I don't believe we've discussed it.
Okay. Well, maybe we can bring it up sometime.
And what about it?
Seems pretty darn mean to me.
Yeah.
Well, what does God require that for?
Yeah. Yeah. Well, it strikes me not so much as mean as strange. It's just a bizarre thing for God to require.
Well, then... I'm glad we at least discussed that.
Yeah. Let me think about it. I think that there are, it does make a certain amount of sense. I mean, there are reasons that could be given as to why that would be an appropriate kind of sign for what God wants to communicate. And I'll try to think of those and list them. Okay, thanks.